even though everyone says I have a lot of work experience, actually I had an internship 3 years ago for 7 weeks. So like I'll tell you this not to like lower my credentials, but because I had a bunch of different stories, I guess, of awkward situations that came up, and this is all in a span of 7 weeks. So if anyone's thinking about working,
when you work, I'd never ask it.
Exactly. So, for anyone that was trying to bet, I apologize if you were at the opening last year at the Alumni Shabbaton. I told one of these stories, probably based on see what's going on here. Probably not that many of you were there. I guess I'll start with when I got my internship. I went to YU, and when I applied, my resume had on it Division Head in Misora. It had the Chesed Club. It had Camp Counselor and Camp Shalom, and it had a 3-week internship in the accounting department for Kedem. That was my whole resume, basically.
Clearly credentials to be a CEO.
Exactly, yes. And so everyone told me I wasn't going to get an internship. I'm like, okay, whatever, let's see. I applied, and I got one internship, one offer from Ernst & Young. Of course, I took it. So everyone asks me, like, oh, like, how'd you get it? Like, that's great. So I went, oh, like, it's Hashem. And people look at me, they're like, no, like, really, how'd you get it? And at that point, I realized, like, even within the Jewish community, like, not everyone really wants to hear all the time about Hashem. Like, they want to hear it was luck, it was this, it was that. So, like, that kind of prepared me really well for when I get to work. And I became friends with a couple guys. There was Miles Austin Hernandez, who was not Jewish, and Stephen Cruz, who was also not Jewish. So these guys became my boys, as I learned that from them. And so Stephen was the guy who sat next to me in my office. My office was made up of Asha, who spells her name with an I. There was, I still don't know her real name, I think Ling, something like that. I never knew what she was saying, and she didn't really talk to me the whole time. There was me, there was Steven, and some other guy whose name I can't remember. So, one day I'm talking to Steven, and he says to me, he's like, do you like music? And I listen to music, but I listen to Jewish music, so I probably don't really know, like, what that is. So he's like, oh, of course, like, Drake. And I'm like, I don't know who that is. So he's like, what do you mean you don't know who it is? He's Jewish. He's a rapper. He's Canadian. And I'm like, none of those things sound like anything I'd be listening to. Who is he? So he's like, oh, he's like the best. He's my favorite musician. Like, you gotta listen to him. So I was like, okay, I gotta listen to him, but it has to be appropriate. So he looked at me, he's like, what does appropriate mean? Like, what is that? Like, what kind of music, what does it mean, inappropriate music? So I went, can't have anything about women, can't have cursing, can't have, like, things about, like, shooting people and drugs. I don't even know what is in these songs, but, like, it has to be appropriate. So he spent all day listening to Drake songs, and finally he found one song. He's like, okay, this one's appropriate. So he had me listen, and it's something to do with, like, 7 days without love makes one weak, spelled with, like, an egg. It was, like, really deep stuff. It was good, yeah. So I told him, I was like, yeah, like, this is pretty good. So he's like, okay, now can I hear your Jewish music? So I'm like, okay, sure. Like, I was trying to think, like, I can't play him, like, Shweki. I can't play Yehuda, exclamation point. Like, these people are not exactly his, like, they're not his, like, favorite. These aren't exactly, like, their idea of music. So I decided on Yaakov Chesed. Everyone knows Yaakov Chesed. Like, they play, like, it's like a band. So I thought, like, maybe he could, like, relate to this. And they have some English songs. So I played one for him. And he listened. And after, like, oh, so what do you think? You know, oh, they were awesome. The guitars especially. That guy's amazing. So, oh, this is really funny, actually. I was just talking to one of them. And their guitar is no longer in the band. So he's like, oh, what happened? Like, drugs, he in jail, like, women. Oh, no, he went to dental school. And so then I realized, like, I can't really relate to these people. Like, I can be friends with them. We had a really nice conversation, but we're different. And to really, like, reinforce that, we were once talking, and I said to him, I was like, yeah, like, I was captain of 3 teams in high school. I was captain of the hockey team, the soccer team, and the softball team. So he goes, like, you're athletic. Like, we should play something. I was like, I'm not really athletic. I was just, like, captain of teams. So he's like, Tommy, he's like, oh, like, I wasn't on any teams. Like, he's like, tell me stories. He plays pickup basketball, pickup soccer, something. He's telling me, he's like, yeah, like, guy dunked on me. A guy did this, guy did that. I was like, in hockey, like, I just run a lot. That's pretty much it. So I realized, like, his whole idea, like, our whole perception, basically, of, like, life is so different than these other people. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that, like, we can't be friendly towards them. So we would schmooze a lot, and I would tell him sometimes about shit updating. He loved that idea. And so we had to go to Chicago once for a conference, and I was suggested a girl in Chicago. And I was, this sounds like a great story. I'll go out with a girl in Chicago, and it'll make for a really romantic ending when we get married. So I tell him, like, yeah, I'm going to be going on this date. So we fly to Chicago, and these limos are to pick us up. So we put, like, 20 people in this limo. We're driving, and he says to me, he's like, oh, so, like, when's your date? And everyone turns and they're like, you have a date in Chicago? What's going on? He's like, yeah, he does this thing where, like, they set you up, and you go out with them, like, then you get married. And we're all, like, 21 at a time. So everyone else looks at me, and they're like, why would you do that? Like, that doesn't sound fun at all. Like, go out to clubs, like, party it up. So I explained to him, like, we don't really, like, touch before marriage, anything like that. And they're like, oh, okay, like, we get it now. Okay, that sounds good. So everyone knew at this point, like, I didn't force it down their throats, but I was very open about things. Like, they would invite me at happy hour. I would say that, like, I'm not going at, like, I don't do that. I don't go to bars. I don't drink. I don't do, like, any of those types of things. And they understood because I was very out there, like, this is who I am, and I'm not forcing it on you, but, like, just so you know, like, it's not, I'm not touching you because you're you. I don't touch, like, anyone. I don't do, like, any of these things. So those were all, like, so eventually, right, so he had a lot of respect for me, I guess, as a Jew. And there was another Jew there who was not so religious yet. Hopefully, I haven't seen her in a couple years. But she once came into our room, and she heard about this whole shit off dating thing, and she asked me, she said, like, would anyone date me even though I am not a basula? She said in a much more vulgar way, though. And this guy, Steven, looked at her, and she's like, he said, you can't use those words with Ethan. Like, he doesn't talk that way. And, like, had my back, because I'm who I am. Like, I wasn't, and he just understood, like, this is not the way that I behave. So just to contrast that with a couple other people who I worked with who were also religious Jews. So one of them came up to me. This is actually a friend of mine who works somewhere else. But he came up to me a couple months ago, and he's like, I need advice. He said, one of the girls I work with, she's having a karaoke bar party. And he went, I don't know what to do because I don't want to hear Kolisha. So I was like, oh, there are tons of different ways you get at this. Say you don't go to bars. He's like, I go to bars with them. So I was like, okay, how about you say this whole thing? You don't, like, listen to music, the destruction of amygdala, like, all that stuff. Like, he's like, but I do all that also. He's like, the only issue I have is Kolisha. So I was like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, you can't all of a sudden, when you're not living a certain way in front of these people, you can't all of a sudden bring up Judaism and be like, I'm not doing this because Judaism, and they're going to be like, but you do this and this and this and this, and, like, you're a walking contradiction. So one other guy who I had a lot to do with on that concept of contradictions and stuff. So one of my clients that I worked for was a multi-billion dollar corporation in the media and entertainment industry. And so when they're really important, when you make a lot of money, so they send important people to, like, make appearances. So the head of the whole media and entertainment for Ernst & Young for New York came and spent a couple days in our office. So he sat next to me, and, like, we became friends. We would schmooze. He would send me a Starbucks. He would tell me to get, like, the pastries, and I, like, would guess on what tastes good, even though I couldn't taste any of them. And so, like, we became, like, friendly people. And so over time, he, like, once heard I lived in Washington Heights, and he's like, oh, my boyfriend, my son's girlfriend lives in Washington Heights. She's a dancer, and he's like, here, he pulls out his iPad, he's like, check out her website. And I was like, this, I don't really want to see this, but, like, so I, like, didn't actually look. I went like this with that, actually, like, looking at it. I was like, oh, very interesting, very interesting. So we became tight, me and Hal. And so Tishba was coming up, and I said to him, I was like, can I ask you a question? Like, I don't really know what to do. There's a holiday coming up, and it would be better if I didn't have to work. But I have a presentation due that day for internships. It was all summer. We were building up to this presentation, and it was on Tisha B'Av. So he said, write an email and tell them that Hal says that you don't need to work. And, like, if they have a problem with it, I'm their boss. Like, don't worry about it. You can take off. So I took off, didn't do a presentation, like, told the lady, she's like, oh, if Hal says so, like, that's fine. One of my friends, though, who had been going to happy hour with them, had been doing all these things that aren't necessarily most appropriate, but he was also, like, a firm guy. So he couldn't get out of it because he hadn't presented himself in a certain way. And not only did he have to show up, but he felt like he had to dress a certain way. He ended up, I don't know, like, why, but he, for some reason, felt like he had to wear leather shoes for a presentation. So, like, on Tisha B'Av morning, before Chatzos, he's there with his leather shoes making this presentation while I'm, like, sitting in shul davening. So, like, not that I'm, like, that amazing, but, like, I had been a certain way, and so therefore later on, I was able to do these things. I guess one other story, and then we'll move on to the next part of this, which will be asking the Rosh Hashiva questions.
You didn't say
what happy hour is. Oh, what happy hour is. So I've never been to one, but the way I understand it is happy hour is basically cheap drinks, I think. Cheap. It's you go to a bar, and like during this time, they're all cheaper, and people do it as like a social hangout type of thing. I don't actually know. That's what I've heard. Does anyone know if I'm wrong? I don't know. If you do, don't raise your hand. But then one other story that happened was, right, okay, so we had to spend a Shabbos in Orlando. We were sent to like Disney World during the 9 days. It was a little uncomfortable for us. But it was this whole like conference, for an international conference with thousands of interns. And it ended on Shabbos morning. So all the Jews, we stayed late. And so I was like a little bit nervous about like Shabbos as a whole, about having Kiddush, having Dal. Like, they told us food would be taken care of. But like, other than the food, like, I didn't know like what was gonna happen. We didn't have a minion, anything like that. So I like emailed all the other guys who I knew were from. I said, like, would you guys be interested, first of all, in like davening together? Like, if we can have a meeting, we could do like Kabbalah Shabbos at least together. We could eat together, stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, sure. Like, they had no problem with that. They weren't going to necessarily organize it, but they weren't against spending time with each other. So we organized. So I put together a thing for each person to bring an item. So one person was going to bring Abdullah, one person brought grape juice. And the person who brought grape juice was actually, I don't know what he calls himself, Orthodox, conservative, whatever it was, he would keep kosher, but he wouldn't fly on Shabbos, but he would do all other malachas. And he was like, he wasn't fasting on Shabbos or B'Tamuz, but he still came with me to go to Mincha, which involves laying everything. I could really like spend a solid 45 minutes walking to the shul, having Mincha, coming back. And like, he wasn't even eating like kosher that day. So like, I don't really know what his deal was exactly, but so he was in charge of bringing the grape juice, and I wasn't so sure about what he would bring, so I brought with me also some sparkling grape juice just in case. And when we show up, he had like Apple and Eve, which is just a random brand of grape juice, which had like a K on it or something like that, and it's not exactly so kosher. And if I didn't happen to have also brought grape juice, so like, we would have had to spend Shabbos without any way of really making Kiddush, other than with these little rules that they had given us, which is very much not the chachila.
Well,
Rabbeinu Tam,
that's fine.
Great. According to Rabbeinu Tam, okay, but still not necessarily the chachila. So, like, these are just, like, so, just as a whole, like, there are a lot of different situations that come up where if you don't think ahead and prepare for these things to happen, or like think about how are you going to handle these situations, so you can easily be caught off guard, and the other people aren't going to be like, oh, it's okay, like, I really know what he meant when he said that I just thought of with someone else. Someone else was Shomer, and everyone knew he was Shomer. He wouldn't touch girls, but he went to one of these happy hours, and he was introduced to one of the girls' friends named Sam, who had like earrings with like the holes in it that, like, I don't know what the point of them are, like, stretch your ear out, and like had like black eyeliner and like spiked hair and everything. And she went like, oh, this is Sam. So he went, oh, nice to meet you, and put his hand out, and she shook it, and this lady went, oh, you're touching girls tonight. He hadn't realized that Sam was a girl. So at that point, his only excuse was, he went, oh, like, I'm a little drunk. So they're like, oh, Avrami's drunk. He tells everyone, like, he's touching girls, like, he doesn't know the difference. And for at night, like, girls are just going up to him, like, touching him, because drunk Avrami touches girls. So, like, they don't understand the fact that, like, he couldn't have been like, oh, I just didn't realize that she was a girl, and, like, oh, I really am sure. Because sure for them isn't, like, a real thing. It's just, he doesn't touch girls normally. So, like, it's, you have to really be, like, on your A-game, or else these things can come up. So, I guess at this point, I have a couple questions I think are useful not only for work but also for college. So I'll ask Rosh Hashiva those, and then afterwards, anyone here that has any questions can also ask questions. So first question is that: are you allowed to be machmir on yourself if you know that other people are not going to be machmir, and it could create a possible chil Hashem that they won't know, that the non-Jews won't know that what you're doing is only a chumrah? They'll think the other person is being mechalal something. For example, this came up in college more than at work, but it comes up at work also. Is there was once a quiz that the quiz was on Chol HaMoed, and the professor, and so I had a question: could I go up to the professor and tell him that if I need to take the quiz, I can, but it would be better if I couldn't, if I didn't take it on this day, because it's better if I don't need to write and all these other things about Chol HaMoed, when I knew that other Jews who dress in a very Jewish, obviously Jewish way, were going to be coming in no matter what to take that quiz on Chol HaMoed. And they might have gotten a psak that it was okay or whatever, but if the professor and the students don't know that, all they see is that one person is saying that he can't do this, or it's better for him not to do it, and the other person is doing it, and they'll see that person think he's doing something wrong.
First, my reaction to everything that Eitan has said is, wow. I am absolutely flabbergasted. I'm floored by your ability to, number one, create all kinds of fences for yourself. Asus Yom LaTorah, which are the kind of Mishnah Pirkei Avos. That's amazing. I mentioned a number of times, I'll try to answer the question while I'm talking. I'm not sure I have a concrete response, but I heard many, many years ago from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal in the 60s. He spoke about the same issue. He spoke about the issue of interacting with non-Jews and being in the workforce. And he was talking actually about a non-Jewish environment, which you are also describing, and things have, shall we say, developed from the 60s to today. Developed is not the right word, but I would say things have evolved and probably deteriorated in many respects in terms of the challenges and the enticements and the allurements that are out there. So he, Avraham Soloveitchik, had the following thesis, and I think that's really what you're trying to do, if I can define it or formulate it. He used two terms. He said that a Jew in the workforce, especially an Orthodox Jew in the workforce, has to be cognizant of two different concepts. One he called fellowship, and the other he called fraternity. And there's a distinction between these two terms, and here's how we define these two terms. That there's no question about it, that fellowship is something which is, obviously, if you want to succeed in the workforce, you have to interact with your fellow, shall we say, worker, with your co-workers, with your bosses, with your superiors, with your underlings, whomever it may be, but certainly you have to be someone who is mikabel kol adam b'sefer panim yafos. Someone who obviously knows how to greet other human beings. That applies, of course, even to non-Jews, no question about it. The Gemara says in Brachas that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he was makdim shalom even to a nochi shebashuk, even to a non-Jew in the marketplace, and that's something which is fundamental and basic. It's ben adam chavero, between man and man. And ben adam chavero, certainly the workforce applies both to Jews and to non-Jews, to anyone you come into contact with. It's essentially what a person should be doing is literally being mekadesh shem shamayim. You should be sanctifying the name of God by acting, shall we say, appropriately and behaving in a way that will only enhance the fact that they see you as an Orthodox Jew, as Eitan really just gave a few scenarios describing a certain consistency, a consistent pattern that he, Baruch Hashem, was able to introduce, unlike perhaps some of his other colleagues who did not take that kind of route. And that's something, all that is clearly designed to, in effect, present a model of what a Jew or what an Orthodox Jew is all about. And in a non-Jewish workforce, that's not easy. That's not a simple thing to do, because you have to know to be able to create guidelines, and you have to be able to somehow to find ways of creating fences that you shouldn't cross the line, as he mentioned a number of times. But that's what Avraham Soloveitchik called fellowship. Fellowship is something which is fundamental and basic, and every Jew certainly has to exhibit that kind of fellowship. Let me just give you an example that I read about in the papers not long ago. This fellow who's a mechanech, who found, he bought a chair. I'm sure you heard about the story. I was told about it. I read one of the papers about it. It actually was carried in many of the papers all over the world, from what I understand. There's some mechanech in Connecticut who apparently bought a chair, and inside the chair, he took it apart because it couldn't fit into his apartment, into his house where he was living in Connecticut. And he took apart the chair and discovered in the chair $98,000. I don't know all the details. Are you familiar with that story? Maybe you.
Yeah, it was a desk.
A desk, sorry. A chair, a desk, whatever it may be. It was a desk, and he found $98,000. And then he went about, since the money was not his, and even though he could easily have justified holding on to the money, he decided not to. I understood that he asked Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, the Rosh Yeshiva in Philadelphia, he asked him, what should he do? Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky told him, after he actually decided to return the money to the owner, he had to actually find out exactly whom the owner was. It said it was a non-Jew, a non-Jewish woman. He didn't publicize her name, because obviously she might have been beset upon by all kinds of people who are, what the Gemara calls inshi d'lo mali, the people who are not so simpatia, as they call them in Hebrew, namely, people who might say, oh, she has $98,000, let's see what we can do. Anyway, he returned the money, and then he went on CNN, and apparently many other, from what I understand, the media, interviewed him, and that was an incredible Kiddush Hashem. They saw an Orthodox Jew, a rabbi with a beard, actually saw his picture, someone showed me, and he returned $98,000. To him, it was a milsim pshita. It was something which was so fundamental, so basic, namely honesty, that he, thank God, Baruch Hashem, absorbed this quality from his teachers, from his parents, from whomever, and that's something that was made such a splash, from what I understood in the headlines, and such a Kiddush Hashem, that was incredible. So that's exactly how a Jew has to behave in the workforce. It means you have to, on the one hand, engage in fellowship. You have to be able to interact with your fellow workers, and they should see you as a normal human being, as someone who can schmooze with them, as I think that's a term that you used, schmooze with them, and literally interact with them wholesomely, and do favors for them whenever necessary, whenever you can, in order that you should be able to be effective in the workforce. That about television is certainly something which is probably an obligation, a chiyuv, not just a nice thing to do, not just eitz tova kamashmalan. Because if you're going to be someone who's a recluse, and someone who's going to keep to yourself, and someone who's going to somehow isolate or quarantine yourself and not interact with others in a gregarious, socially acceptable kind of fashion, they'll look upon you as someone who is a, how shall we describe that person? Clearly someone who's not just a recluse, but someone who is socially not very hospitable, someone who does not know how to be convivial, someone who's not a normal human being. You want to be seen as a normal human being, even though you have your own Orthodox practices, you have your own Jewish practices, your own Torah practices, whatever it may be. However, Avraham Soloveitchik said it should not cross the line into what he called fraternity, where you start, you know what fraternities are on university campuses, I assume you're familiar with that. And so, once you start fraternizing means a lot of the things that were mentioned here by Eitan a moment ago, namely all the different partying type of venues that exist out there, and they exist, there's no question about it. I just came back from the States, and this week is the week of, I don't think I've been to the States in 19 and a half years, it is Tkufa, and I forgot all about it. I'll tell you how I remembered. A Santa Claus fellow approached me. This happened this week. He approached me, and I was taken aback. He wanted to hug me. I'm not sure exactly why, but okay. I'm not sure exactly what we had in common, but he wanted to hug me, this fellow, and I was a little bit taken aback. I decided not to play it cool, and so he comes over to me, and he wanted to hear even more astounding, the next statement. He says, he looks at me, and then he says in Hebrew, he says to me, Ata Echad Mishalanu. I always flipped out. I was painted on the spot. You're one of us, he told me. He was an Israeli. I said, Lama Ata Osedze. I said, what are you doing this for? He says, Kesef. Or what Dr. Mickey Mark calls Yerushalayim. I was astounded. I'm absolutely astounded. So here, I'm just telling you, so I know I was in the Yuletide season, the Xmas season. Actually, one time I was able to learn a little bit of Gemara. I started learning Gemara to the tune of Jingle Bells. I mean, just saying, but you can't imagine the impact that something can have just being in a certain kind of environment. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, you cannot fraternize. Fellowship, yes. Fraternity, no. That was his distinction. He spoke about it for 2.5 hours. I'm only giving you the tip of the iceberg. That's what he spoke about. And so that, I think, is what Eitan is trying to develop over here. This kind of distinction between fellowship and fraternity. Now, the lines of demarcation are not so clear. I think they're rather blurred. And you have to really, on your own, be able to define, or to delineate, or to demarcate what yes, what no, how far will I go, to what extent I'm going to become involved, etc., in all kinds of different possible entanglements. That's not a simple thing. And the only way you can be successful in doing that, according to my own opinion, I'll get to the question if you want. The only way, I'm trying to think of the answer. But anyway, the only way you could actually make sure you're not going to be involved in any of these entanglements is by becoming more anchored. So Eitan is happens to be, I'm not saying, I don't think Chidushim, Mikdash Shvachas Shvachim, he is someone who is anchored. Anchored in Torah and anchored in mitzvot, and very committed, and someone who Baruch Hashem, less number of years, has really grown and developed tremendously, and that has given him the ability, the wherewithal, the fortitude, and the shall we say, the resources to be able to handle this kind of environment, because it's not easy to handle this kind of environment. We're talking about women, and how shall we put it, women, wine, and song, the trilogy, whatever the case is. That this is what you're going to encounter in a workforce, in a natural workforce, a normal workforce. That I went last week on behalf of the yeshiva to try to raise money for the yeshiva. I was in many, many different offices. I saw many interesting things. But just because I think it was this season, because of this, it is this season to be jolly. Da 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 da. Anyway, I encountered a number of things that were very fascinating to me in terms of the culture that's out there and the like, including the sanitation they're into. They're all over the streets, those people. You know what I'm talking about? What do they call them? The Salvation Army. Sorry, sanitation. I apologize. Salvation Armies everywhere. They're all over everywhere. All over New York, New Jersey. I even met them in Muncie. I was based in Muncie. Muncie, you know, my benching, it says with name Muncie, you're our Kodesh Meheri, I may not. I'm just joking. Anyway, but the okay, back to the question. So he asked let's say I have a chumra regarding Chol HaMoed, and I'm not writing to take a quiz, that's what this discussed, even though unquestionably there's a makom lahakel. And the specific question that was asked, assuming you go to class in Chol HaMoed, there's a makom lahakel, because it could be it's a davar ha'aveid. And based on what Paskim say, Davar Avi and the Chol HaMoed is permissible, you'll have to write. Namely, if somebody you're going to, as a result, lose, namely whether you lose in terms of marks, in terms of your ability to move ahead. So there's certainly a market to be lenient. So perhaps maybe that example is not the ideal example, although it's a beautiful Chumrah, and it's a good Chumrah that I want you to try to be Mekabel upon myself, etc. Now, the question over here is, here you might impact a whole group of people, because they can't distinguish between you and other Jews, or other Orthodox Jews who are present on the campus. And so here you have to somehow use your judgment. You have to try to examine and carefully scrutinize and see what the situation is. What kind of impact will this have on others? That's what you're alluding to. And if the impact is going to be negative on them, as far as what you're concerned. So here I think that you could find a makom lahakel, as far as writing in terms of the quiz, etc., etc. The example I don't think is the ideal example.
I specifically chose it because of the fact that there's Israel.
No, but then I think you have to be concerned. Any Jew who's in a workforce, an Orthodox Jew especially, has to be concerned. As I said, your entire impetus should be to be Mekadosh Shem Shamayim, to sanctify the name of Hashem, and they should see you as a Torah observant Jew who's Mekadosh Shem Shamayim, but it should not impact negatively other Jews, whether they're Orthodox Jews, or it doesn't make a difference. It should not impact negatively how they perceive, because you already drew distinctions and they already discriminated between you who behave in a certain kind of way and other Jews who behave differently, and therefore they're not consistent. They saw contradictions, they saw hypocrisy perhaps even in the behavior of others. While you were consistent, it's not easy to be consistent. It's not easy to be, shall we say, one has to be a Baal Madrega in order to be able to maintain that kind of consistency, and you always have to constantly make judgments and constantly make decisions, and these decisions are often made on the spot and in situations you don't really have much time to think about it carefully, what to do, what not to do. So I'm not here to, God forbid, condemn anyone or indict anyone. I think that's an error. I think in general, the approach has to be that l'chatchila should try to the extent that being punctilious regarding Jewish law, I certainly should go all the way if I possibly can, but as long as it doesn't really have a negative impact on, let's say, how Jews are perceived in general. The primary objective of a Jew in the workforce, especially in a secular workforce where there are non-Jews working with you, is to be Mekadosh Shem Shamayim, to sanctify the name of Hashem as best you can. Let them see that observance of the Torah is something which you can do and still be effective and be successful and do your work in a constructive way and be obviously enhance the what has happened over there in that particular setting, but at the same time maintain your, shall we say, allegiance to, I mean, the Rabbi Soloveitchik, not Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik now, but Rabbi Soloveitchik, his older brother, Rabbi Yossi Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, was my Rebbe. So he contended that this is really the major and primary and preeminent mandate of a Jew living in the secular world. He was talking about not just in the Chutzaret, it also applies even to Eretz Yisrael in some respects, but namely the notion of Ger Betosha Manochi in Bochim. And he commented on this many, many times in many different contexts, in many different ways, that the Jew has to learn how to be both a Ger and a Tosha. What is a Tosha? A Tosha is a settler. A Tosha is someone who is essentially part of the landscape, part of the scene, that you have to contribute to society from every standpoint, a civic standpoint, a social standpoint, an economic standpoint. You have to make contributions to the world at large, but at the same time recognizing that you are a ger, that we are different, that our lifestyle is different, our theology is different, our destiny is different. We have a different, shall we say, worldview, a different existential kind of outlook, or a different Weltschauung, a different Hashkafic outlook on the world. So you have to try to maintain both. Of course, if you're a Briska, you know how to do it, because Brisk is all dialectic. Brisk is all Tzvedinim, correct? So on the one hand, you can be both a Ger and a Toshav, and that's the way one has to operate. Now, it's not easy. It's certainly not easy. That it's a tensile balance sometimes between these two forces or these two concepts. But if one is, as I said, anchored in our heritage, as one should be, and that's why one goes to yeshiva, and one continues to learn Torah, and one continues to maintain one's fidelity to mitzvahs and what have you, and one has a Rebbe, a Seder HaRav, and one has someone that one can talk to, one has mentors, and the like. So I think it's possible to do both, and try to do it in a way where you will, as I said, hopefully be Mekadosh Shem Shammai. Rabbi Raji, perhaps you.
I'm just going to add in that there's a bunch of Torah tribe guys. The ones that have the easiest time in these situations, or the smoothest time, are the ones that could just dial a number and call, you know, either a Shiva or one of the Rabbanim, and have a Rav in America, a Rav here, and ask them, this is my situation, what do I do right now? And the Rosh Shiva is very good at getting back to all this. I mean, just within 24 hours, it sounds like. And
since I'm technologically illiterate, the only access I have is to a telephone. And so I call people back.
It's the most precious, valuable thing you can have when leaving here, is a Rav that you continue to always ask questions to in all these different types of scenarios that you can't possibly list all of them and prepare for all of them ahead of time.
There's a Ramban in Chumash. Am I allowed to add a Ramban? The Ramban in Chumash has a number of times a very fascinating concept that he mentions two or three times. In the beginning of Kedoshim, where the Torah says Kedoshim to you, you're familiar with that pasuk. The beginning of Kedoshim says a very famous Machlokas Rashi in the Ramban, what the pshat in that pasuk is. Rashi learns because of the juxtaposition to the previous parsha, Acharemos, that delineates all the Arayas. The Arayas are delineated in two parshas, one in Acharemos, one in Kedoshim. There are distinctions between the two as well. But however, so Rashi understands that what does it mean Kedoshim to you? That Prushim in Arayos, keep away from illegitimate relationships, illegitimate sexual relationships. That's how Rashi understands. Ramban develops a whole thesis, a very famous thesis, Kaddish Atzmecha B'Mutalach, that even in areas you are permitted to engage in, whether it's speaking, whether it's eating, etc., etc., the Ramban says there you have to try to discipline yourself. You have to lead a disciplined kind of lifestyle. Don't engage in excesses, don't go overboard, don't overindulge. And listen, all of us from time to time, we're human beings, and we obviously, to be human is to err. We make errors, all of us make errors. I make many of them probably every 10 minutes. Whatever the case is, we certainly make errors, and we have to try to correct them and use the errors as a means, as a kind of yirida l'tzarech aliyah. We descended in all in order to ascend. But the Ramban has this concept, Kedushim to you, which you try to strive for Kedusha. Kedusha means self-discipline. That's how the Ramban understands it. We should be in control. Our seichel should be in control of our bodies. So the Ramban says the Torah cannot possibly list every scenario. That's what Rabbi Blaski was referring to. The Torah cannot list every scenario where this particular, shall we say, mandate or directive is certainly operative and relevant. Or, for example, Vasisa Yashimato. Another example, the Ramban also describes this, develops this idea, how we have to be honest in business. Honest in our business dealings. You have to be yashar. Not to engage in any kind of deceit or duplicity or dishonesty. That's probably, according to my humble opinion, that's the most important message that the Torah has to deliver. Yashuas, that we have to be straight and glatt, not under the table, not do things, shall we say, in a way which would, Rahman al-Tzon, God forbid, might lead to a chil lashem, might lead to a desecration of God's name. We have to be honest and straight the entire way, and that really is the ideal of what a Jew is all about. What the Netziv describes in his Akdama, so yeah, the Ramban also says, the Torah gives us a number of examples of what it means about Sisa Yashurata. It can't go into every scenario. And as Rablaski said, there are infinite number of scenarios that happen on a daily basis, and therefore it's very difficult for us to again. So you have to try to chew up Rob Yoetz, to consult. Rabbi Roblosky mentioned to have a Rav or a Rebbe or a Rav in a shul, whatever it may be, or people that you can talk to about this, or other people who are in the workforce longer than you, who have more experience. That's what Eitan obviously alluded to as well. Again, other people can give you advice, because it's very important to ask others for advice, because the Gemara says that kol negoyim adam roya chutz midigei atzmo, it's a mission in the goyim, that everyone sees every nega. I see everyone's peccadillos, weaknesses, except for mine. I have no peccadillos, of course not. I'm, shall we say, God's gift to humanity. I'm the perfect specimen. What else, what could there be? Anything more perfect than I am? I'm a Baruch Hashem Tzvokas, I'm an angel. No one is an angel, and no one has that kind of capacity. So you have to recognize, each one of us has to recognize our shortcomings and our weaknesses, and there are many, many stumbling blocks along the way. Work is something which the Chazal, the Torah, actually very clearly, and I would say almost unreservedly, unconditionally, accentuates the importance of work. It's a Mishnah Perkiyavis, it's a Gemara Bracha, it's all over Shas. The Gemara says in Kedushin, the obligation of fathers to teach his son, umnas, a trade. That's with the obligation to go ahead and work in a way which is constructive, which is wholesome, and there's no question that work has many, many pluses, but at the same time, it also creates and engenders all kinds of challenges and what have you, and we have to try to face them as best we can. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Rabbi Rashi. No, not adding, I just want to ask Rosh Hashiva if the room to be manned is specifically in that example. What about the other examples that were mentioned, to like going to bars for happy hour? Maybe if you don't go, you'll be a chilul Hashem because other people.
See, here I think Rabbi Reichman's point is well taken. It's sort of implicit, embedded in the question that he's asking. I think there are distinctions to be made between writing in chol hamoed and going into a bar. I think it's fairly evident. The Gemara has in Avodah Zarah so many different gedarim, especially one of the gedarim that the Chazal had. The Chumash we have the concept of Yishtu Yein Nesichem, the concept of Yai Nesach. But there's a notion of Astam Yeinam, essentially not drinking with non-Jews because of the conviviality that's created. Because when a person is drunk, as Eitan described a moment ago, a drunken drunken person clearly is, shall we say, he's going to behave differently. He's allowed to do all kinds of things once he's drunk, because onus rachmana patre, and once a person is shatui, once you already are under the influence of drink, so then obviously you are a different person. No, I think Rabbi Reichman is correct, 100% correct. I think one has to be extremely careful about that. That is a line that one should not cross. It means you have to go ahead and, shall we say, establish yourself certain boundaries, and this should be one of the boundaries about not drinking. By the way, I have many, many balabatim. I'm a rav in a shul. I have many balabatim, been a rav for many, many years, and many balabatim who work in the non-Jewish world, lock, stock, and barrel. They don't work with other Jews. They work with non-Jews. It literally, that's exactly who they work with entirely, in toto. And they're extremely careful. They try to be as careful as they can. Again, especially in this particular area, when it comes to drinking and the like, and I would say women as well, those are two areas that one has to be extremely cautious, very careful. One has to set down guidelines and boundaries, because these are areas that are very easily, if we cross them, then we can sometimes easily lose control. And it's very difficult. You don't want to lose control. You also don't want to, in any way, God forbid, create any kind of chilul Hashem. And you don't want to, shall we say, you want that their perception of a Jew, especially an Orthodox Jew, should be a perception which is one, as I described earlier, of wholesome kind of behavior. No, you should, go ahead. Good, okay, fine.
My answers aren't as thorough.
No, my answers are also not thorough, but they're just, shall we say, as best as I can. And I think one has to go ahead and try, to the extent that one can, to make those discriminating distinctions. The Gemara says, "Emein das Abdullah minayin." The reason why our salvation is to come, and why the first bracha is Ashenasal Asech Vivino La'achim Yom Ve'Loila. Brachas Hashachar we say in the morning. So there are a number of different approaches. Some say because we are essentially distinguishing that between day and night. That's why we daven in the morning. That's why that's the first bracha. Some say Sechvi refers first to Lev, refers to the heart. But Rav Soloveitchik felt that this bracha is critical, because the most important ability that one has to acquire in life is the ability to make discriminating distinctions. If you want to be a lamnin, which you, Baruch Hashem, all you are budding Tamil Chachamim, you have to make discriminating distinctions between Sugya A and Sugya B, between, shall we say, Rashi and Tesed, between Abaye and Rava. You have to understand, and that's really what the learning experience is all about. about to make discriminating distinctions. And the Gemara says, "Amein das, havdala minayin." If you don't have das, you haven't acquired the requisite ability to make those distinctions, that means something is still not yet, you haven't fully developed in terms of what you should be. So we're on our way. All of us are on our way, and we continue to develop and emerge. So he will say, you have to make distinction. That's what Rachman is saying. Distinction between perhaps writing and Chol HaMoed, which happens to be a din in Shulchan Aruch, and there was certainly the ideals to be machmir regarding Ksiva Chol HaMoed. There's a whole question about whether a computer, using a computer, is that called writing al pei halacha? That's a whole discussion, a whole deal in the Poskim. But whatever the case is, certainly there's a far distinction, and he correctly pointed out and correctly, shall we say, interpolated that there's a distinction between that and, let's say, going into a bar, drinking, and involving women. I've just extended to that as well. There, I think one has to delineate clear distinctions and guidelines in order that one should not be drawn further into areas which might, Rachman Litzlan, really lead to, God forbid, terrible consequences.
Should I go with the next question?
Yeah, yeah.
Or should we see if there's...
No, questions on the floor. Why not? Yeah. Whatever you think.
So does anyone have any questions for that specific question? Or else I could ask a second question.
If you have the situation where you have to, obviously, if you pick your Judaism and say, like, oh, I can't do such and such an act, how do you phrase it in a way that won't come off as, like, insulting as is the situation? So a lot of people get offended, and they think, like, oh, you're kind of, like, better than me mentality.
No, I don't think, again, I think, obviously, you have to formulate. First of all, it would be worthwhile if you plan on going into the workforce. And for anyone who's in the workforce, you should already, shall we say, try to prepare beforehand by having your own, shall we say, positions already. I'm not saying that to be concretized, but you have to try to think through all these issues, potentially, as Eitan suggested earlier. You have to think what's going to be. You have to think what possible challenges might I face that now I would have to go ahead and formulate responses. But I think formulate responses in general, I think people just, if you don't speak down to people and you don't come with an arrogance and you don't come, shall we say, as someone who is with a swagger, I'm talking about articulate a swagger, you have to obviously speak to someone as if they are clearly, in general, when you speak to people, obviously you're machshiv them, you have to show them that you consider them to be obviously VIPs, each person you speak to, and the greatest of Gedolei Yisrael, they had that ability to do that. Or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, any single person who spoke to him felt like he was, shall we say, worth $1 million. That's how we spoke to people. That's how we have to learn to speak to every human being. No distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew, etc. And here we have to be Mekadosh Shem Shammai. I don't think it's that difficult to go ahead and formulate a response. I agree. Sometimes it's subtle, it's nuanced. You have to be careful what you say. But if you thought about it and you think about it all the time and how I'm going to respond to someone and how I will explain. That, by the way, in some cases, that's what Eitan pointed out. You have to explain what you exactly, you're an Orthodox Jew, a religious Jew. These are some of the values that you hold dear. People respect that. That's what we hear. That's what we heard before. People respect that. If you present it in a sentient, intelligent, rational kind of fashion, you don't have to give them a comprehensive lecture. You don't have to give them a, shall we say, present an encyclopedic mastery of the entire Talmud and present it to a non-Jew that you're working with. But I think they'll get the point that these people clearly got the message. They understood very well exactly where he was headed for. And that's how you present it as clearly, and I would say as simply as you can. I'm going to get into great sophistication. I don't think it's necessary.
If you would say in such a case like, oh, I don't touch girls because my religion, I'm a Jew, and they call, but this guy over here is Jewish, he touches girls. So like,
how
do you say that?
I think that you have to be very careful. Again, I'm not sure what the approach would be. I think it probably depends on the circumstances. I'd be careful not to in any way demean the other Jew, but indicate there perhaps are, shall we say, those who are, again, this may sound again like a kind of arrogance that you obviously want to avoid. You want to disabuse the person of. But there are, unquestionably, there are Jews, I think Eitan alluded to this before, there are Jews who have reached a certain level of observance, others who are on the way, who are trying to achieve that level of observance. You know, they're different levels. They're different. Not everyone is of the same, shall we say, commitment. And we're all trying to get there. That's our interest is to get to the, hopefully to hit a home run and finally get to, shall we say, get around all the bases. But not everyone is there yet. People at first base, second base, service. Not that you're saying this with any kind of braggadocio. You're not trying to brag. You're not trying to engage in any kind of arrogance, or you're not being overweening, or you're not being somehow arrogant. No, you have to try to say in a way where, and people understand their different levels of observance, of course they understand that.
I could just add something to that. When I mentioned, like, to these people that I don't touch girls, like, that's why I'm, like, why Jews as a whole, like, aren't going out partying and they're looking to get married at a younger age. It was like a very basic explanation to them, but it wasn't relevant to their to that moment. There was nothing embarrassing to them by me telling them that. It's very different than, and this is probably going to be a question that will come up a lot when all the alumni come back, they love asking a question. It's very different than when a girl comes up to you and doesn't know that you're a showmer and puts her hand out. And at that point, to look at her and go, I don't touch girls, is extremely, in my opinion, like I don't want to give a halakha, but in my opinion, that would be much more inappropriate to not to be like, I don't touch girls, and like, I don't even know you, but I'm not going to shake your hand. Like, that is very different than in the process of a conversation bringing up, like, yeah, it happens to me, like, we don't touch girls. And then, like, and so now these people now know that, and so they're not going to put their hand out towards you. But you're not shoving it down their throat in the moment in any way that would be embarrassing towards them. It's, there's a very big difference in between those two.
So if you got in that situation, what would you do, personally?
Is this their shoe on answer? I can tell what like remorse that Willie says. Like he has that funny says that if someone puts their hand out, there's you could get there's the dead fish and the bone crusher. if anyone wants a demonstration, show them he's more in favor of the dead fish than the bone crusher just from a Calabrio standpoint.
There are tshuvas about this. There, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a famous tshuva about this topic. Others also, but okay, you quoted Rabbi Willie. Rabbi Moshe is not to the Achmir in this particular situation. I mean, there's the issue of Kavod Abrius. That's the issue he's written. The Gemara in Brachos, the test. Kavod Abrius, Doichel Osasi Shabbatayra. The question, what are the parameters of that? Let's speak to Rabbi Reichman since he wrote the Sefer on it. This, again, it's an achlogus ha-poskim. There are poskim the whole of Kavod Willig and who feel that in order not to embarrass someone who put out his hand to you, again, it's not being done. It's based on the Shach and based on the Rambam and based on the number of fundamental positions in poskim that, again, we're talking about contact, which is not l'shem chiba, contact which is clearly simply out of courtesy, as a kind of salutation, or people are greeting you. So there are those poskim who feel they have a makom l'hakir. Ramesh is neitel l'achmir, but at the same time, he weighs the question. You see that he's really wrestling with the issue in terms of yes or no. So I mean, but there's no question. Eitan is right. There's a clear distinction between whether you're going to have a conversation with someone and then eventually, in the course of the conversation, shall we say, more or less present your your manifesto or present your program or your guideline or where you're at, as opposed to someone who came up to you and suddenly out of the blue, you know, extends their hand to you and how you're going to react to that. I was present once at a convention where the following happened at this convention, and I was absolutely appalled by what happened. It so happened that this convention was a I'd rather not delineate exactly the particulars of the convention, but it was a convention I attended. A convention of actually, there were educators at this convention, primarily educators. There were obviously some rabbis among them as well. And in the course of it, one session was chaired by a woman. She was the MC of this session. And so she called up a gentleman who was supposed to address the audience. And as he came up, so the woman extended her hand to him. In front of approximately, I would say, almost 1,000 people. And then this gentleman was clearly very observant, very firm, and he essentially all of a sudden recoiled. I think he almost fell off the stage. That was also quite humorous, if you're going to call it that. And then she again extended her hand to him, and then he proceeded to sort of recoil further and run back, and then she went after him. She lunged after him. It was just a very, very awkward, uncomfortable situation. I myself was in stitches. I have to be honest with you. I shouldn't have been in stitches, but I was. I'm just a human being. What can I do? And I was basically out of control. I was just, and then she continued to lunge after him, and he continued to recoil. He turned anywhere, literally doing circles there on stage, and the audience was absolutely. There were different reactions, of course, depending on the people. I didn't have this many, many years ago. I was considerably younger than I am today, several decades ago, and I was just taken aback by the whole thing. I thought it would have been, in those circumstances, again, I'm not here to issue a psak. There's a big machlokes haposkim about the matter. You have to try to use your judgment and your seichel. Again, seichel is very important. Seichel is something that also we have to acquire. Seichel, a lot of it. The more we have, the better off we are. And that's not something that's easy acquirable. It takes years of experience and sometimes a lot of, as I said, a lot of learning and a lot of encounters with different. When people are younger, much younger, they're sort of, there are a lot of new situations that they're encountering that are difficult for them to know what to do. But if you have a certain degree of experience that you acquire and you hopefully are able to, you know, develop your own worldview, your world outlook on many, many different matters, so then you'll be able to handle these matters hopefully more efficiently and hopefully in a way which will not, chas v'shalom, create this kind of scenario that I'm describing to you.
Let's say, like, if you're working or you're in college and you get a project and, like, your project person happens to be a woman.
It's a very common phenomena. I've encountered this in the last 40 years of my life. Obviously, there are ideal situations and situations that are not ideal. Sometimes people are assigned a particular partner, whether it's in a lab or any other kind of setting, they're assigned by the professor, or by the instructor, by the teacher, etc. Again, it's clearly not ideal to be involved in that kind of a setting. Often you're able to actually extricate yourself if you want to. It's best, again, if you assume you have no choice, and that's the setup that you have, then you have to try to handle it. It's clearly not ideal, that's for sure. I mean, for obvious reasons, and so one has to be careful to try to, if one can, usually one can. I'm involved in this issue for the last 40 years of my life. With many, many college students, both young men and young women, who discuss this matter with me many, many times, literally tens and tens of times. And it's not uncommon. Not uncommon at all. People, or shall we say, borrowing someone who goes to class. Sometimes there are classes and days that you can't go to class, such as Yom Tov, the middle of the week, things of that sort. And then you want to take, you want to get someone's, computerized notes, whatever it may be. And there are women involved, etc. So you find ways of doing it where you're not going to, shall we say, hopefully compromise anything. It's not easy. It's a challenge. Obviously, it's a challenge.
So sometimes. I understand.
I want to point out, I'm not the only one who has to respond to questions here. I only have one thing over my colleagues: age. That's about it. I don't have anything else over them. So please feel free to speak to Rabbi Fuchs, who's with it.
Rabbi's good looks.
Good looks, that must be. I'm telegenic. Other than that, Baruch Hashem, we have three outstanding, wonderful rabbis here. Feel free to speak with them. Oh, four, I'm sorry. Rabbi Green is still here? Was here. Okay. In absentia, Rabbi Green. Okay, go ahead.
I understand, like, the dead fish or everything, if it's a situation that shows up once in a while, but sometimes people have jobs that they're constantly meeting new people, and it's a daily thing that you're going to be meeting a woman and you're putting your hand out. So would it be, like, would somebody be able to just take such a huge cool on himself and just decide to shake all their hands, or not shake, but whatever?
I don't think it's ideal, what you're suggesting, by any means, that's for sure. But you're right, these situations can come up on a daily, ongoing kind of basis. And again, I think that it really depends. I don't think you could really formulate clothing. I think it depends really on the particular situation one finds oneself in, what your role is, what exactly, how people view you, how people see you. There are many, many factors, clearly. I don't think you can generalize the whole situation. What you're describing is obviously not ideal by any means. You know, I know someone who did the following, which he was viewed as an absolute lunatic, and you'll understand why in a second. He decided, because since he's makpid, and as one should be, on contact with women, he wore gloves. Who wears gloves to work? And any time a woman approached him, he shook her hand. And it's all questionable whether this is a halacha correct thing or not. Probably is not, but whatever the case is, he would shake her hand with his glove on. And he subsequently told me they thought he was zany, that he was some screws were missing apparently, some gray matter was not given to him. You have to also do things in a fashion that are viewed to be normal behavior, not abnormal behavior. I agree, this is a major challenge. I understand what you're saying, and I'm not sure there's a clear answer. But obviously you're encountering a very formidable, challenging situation. I'm not answering your question, as you can see.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes based on the personality of the guy who's in the situation, he might be able to get around it by being so overly friendly instead of shaking their hand, not in an appropriate way, but just, hi, it's so good to see you, and then kind of completely ignore the hand, and should never think that you're insulting her because she sees how happy you are to see her.
Okay.
Some people are able to do this.
Okay, so I guess we'll, I have a lot of questions, but we won't get to all of them, but just a next question, I guess, is, as the Rosh Yeshiva mentioned, I have, Rosh Hashem, grown a lot, I guess it's my year in Yeshiva, and so when I, like 3 years ago, when I got this offer for this job, I wasn't ready necessarily to start working, just from a religious standpoint, and so I've had many conversations with Rosh Yeshiva at this point about whether I should be starting, if I should keep learning. So if one has the ability to not start right away, so what are, if there was a checklist of the, for the Rosh Yeshiva to make of things that one should make sure he's steadfast in before he starts work, when is one ready basically to start working?
So at the end of the day, the more learning one has under one's belt, the more one is fortified to handle these kinds of situations and to deal with the world, because you're more anchored. You're more anchored in Torah, you're more anchored in mitzvahs, you're more anchored in your commitment, you're more anchored in your emunah, you're more anchored in your understanding of what the Torah, Belshang, is all about. So obviously, I'm not saying that one should delay. I mean, often people obviously are going to go into medicine. Use that as an example. You have to go to medical school. Medical school is a long haul. It could be Rabbi Apfel, Rabbi Dr. Apfel, went to medical school for 14 years. You hear that? 14 years. He's, of course, a cardiologist. He's a surgeon. When you're a surgeon, you have to go to medical school. You can't. There are no shortcuts. Nor should there be shortcuts, chas v'shalom. So I'm saying to you that here again, and here also, again, the more one is, shall we say, really, really anchored in Limud HaTorah, the stronger you're going to become. That's the way it is. The more your commitment will be sharpened and will be focused, and you'll be able to handle the situation. But listen, at the end of the day, people have to go to work. People have to make a panosa. It's a chiyuv. It's a mitzvah. It's an obligation. You cannot forsake your obligation, as I said many times. And Mike Subit says, I learned Subis before I got married. Not just the first paragraph of Subis, I learned the other program as well. Ba'ana, with your father, Shlita. Anyway, so Ba'ana Eflach Ve'ezon Va'Furnace. It says, I'm going to support, sustain, and shall we say, be committed to making a living. I told this story, I've told this many, many times. I was at a chasa with Rabbi Pam, the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Das, Rabbi Pam Zatzal. I was under the chuppah, I was an aide. I knew the fellow was getting married. He was marrying, he was a boy who was learning in Torah Das in the Kollel. He was marrying a girl who was getting a PhD, which in those circles is not exactly so common, I don't think, as far as I know. Anyway, so Rabbi Pam is waiting. I don't know what's happening. There was no wine. They were waiting for wine for the chuppah. You spoke about it earlier. Grape juice, sparkling, etc. Anyway, so the he's waiting for wine to come. And there's a massive chuppah with hundreds and hundreds of people. And all of a sudden, Rabbi Pam, jokingly, tells the chassan the following, in Yiddish. He says, Shteitach in the ksuba, and says in my ksuba, V'ano eflach. I'm going to work. So he says to the chassan jokingly, Z, she's going to work. And then he says, V'ano izon, I will sustain. Z, she's going to sustain. Afarnes, Z, she's going to provide the panosa. So he says, what does it say next in the ksuba? Ekor, honor. So he says, Chotch Ekor, at least you'll, hopefully you'll honor her. He didn't realize the mic was on. The whole place heard this conversation. People absolutely, I almost couldn't control myself either. I was right next to my pop. He was so embarrassed. Pashut, I didn't know. I felt so bad for him, but I got such a kick out of that. I must tell you, it was mind-boggling. I was so taken by that conversation. Now, he said in a very joking kind of, Rabbi Pam had a tremendous sense of humor. Those who knew him, tremendous. I knew him very well. And both him and his son, Rabbi Pam, and two of his other sons, I also know, I'm saying, tremendous sense of humor. But he was saying something that was very, very, I would say, quite significant. Okay, back to this issue. The issue is that to the extent that a person could continue to learn, one has to try to do so. Because 1 year of learning Torah, even 2 years of learning Torah, you have to, now this should become Mitzvah Shem for you, a lifetime. Hopefully you develop the skills this year, next year, whatever, etc., and the rest of your life to continue growing and become stronger and stronger in your commitment to learning, in your, not just commitment, but in your love of Torah and in your cheshik for Torah. That's really the most important thing. A desire to learn and the recognition that really that's what we're all about. This is our life. These are our lives. Of course we have to work. Of course we have to make panasa. Of course we have to do all that. Whether you do it a little bit later, a little bit earlier, again, that depends on circumstances. Some people have to go to work because they obviously have to make a living, which, as I indicated, is an obligation, a chiyuv. No question about it. Other people can delay it a bit longer and learn a bit more, but at the end of the day, you have to go to work. That's what it boils down to. El trabaja. Working. That's my Spanish. I just picked it up in New York again. Yo hablo español muy poco. I was in an area, I was in Washington Heights, but I was in an area where there were a lot of Spanish-speaking people. Matter of fact, Mickey was, that's Rabbi Mickey Mark over here, so he asked me whether I speak Spanish fluently. Actually, one time I did, in the streets of New York, La Ciudad de Nueva York, but I, since many years already, I lost it. You don't practice it, so you lose it, whatever the case is. One of the parents we met, actually, someone in the yeshiva, speaks Spanish fluently. I had a conversation in Spanish. Brought back memories. So I think that to the extent that you're able to continue learning, and as much as you can do that, you continue to do so. But it depends on the circumstances, and there's no one rule for everyone.
Are there, within, outside of the situation that comes up at work, there are many other factors for someone working, as far as getting up early for having dami, for what should you be learning, things like that. Should one be preparing for certain things, or should one just learn whatever, like, as well as they can before they come to work?
In general, I always feel that ein adam lo meid al makom shelibo chafetz. You have to learn that which you enjoy doing. Again, ideally, one should. If you're a doctor, you better know Hilchos Shabbos. That's all I can tell you. You better know Hilchos Shabbos al Buryo Shin Chav Ches. You should know by heart, literally by heart. Better than all the rabbanim in the world, because you have the Paskin Shilas that are relevant to Chilul Shabbos and the like, and those are very significant. In general, all of us have to know Hilchos Shabbos. You have to know halacha. You have to know what to do, how to behave, and what to do, and when to do, etc., etc. Every single Jew requires that knowledge. But you also have to be able to enjoy that which I'm learning. And all of us have different, shall we say, areas that we find to be more enjoyable, less enjoyable. At the end of the day, we all have to learn that which we enjoy learning, which we like to learn. I think that's very, to me, according to my humble opinion, that's what one should try to do, to not focus on that, as opposed to, I don't know, of course all of us have to know all Nashim Nezikim and eventually Kachim and Taris and go to Kala Torah Kula. That's all very nice and dandy, but now being realistic, we have to be realistic. So it's important to learn areas that I enjoy learning, learn Halacha also. Everyone should try to learn Halacha. There's so many different compendiums today. You don't have to learn the entire Mishnah Berurah. I mean, L'chatchila, of course, one should, if one can, but you have to be realistic in terms of time constraints and other factors that come into play, and you have to try to do that which is practicable and doable and functionally utilitarian. That's what you have to do. I'm very big on this Sefer by Rabbi Ribiyad, I call the Great Bible on Hilchos Shabbos. You know, the four volumes. One volume could actually, I don't think you have to learn that volume that deals with Davashem, Miskavi, Melachshet, Ufa. That you'll leave to, you know, the for another time when you have, for Daniel. So he'll handle that area. And I'm saying, but the three volumes that deal with Melachshet, I don't mean to embarrass you, Daniel, but I'm saying, but the Lamentes Melachis, as we discussed with me this morning when I came back, he brought me back to my bearings. I don't know what was happening. He all of a sudden brought me all over Shas and the Darshim Lufa and Darshim Skavin. I'm just saying that I'm speaking in terms of those three volumes are beautiful volumes. Beautiful. The Mechaber, I think I told the story. I met him, the Mechaber, at a wedding. I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. Wedding of my nephew married his niece. So he comes to the wedding, Rabbi Ribiyad, and he tells me that he put out a Sefer. I don't know why he came to me, because I have a beard probably or something along those lines anyway, so there were a lot of beards at that wedding. And he tried to sell the Sefer to all the beards at the wedding. He tells me he has a Sefer, so I ask him, can I see it? He immediately produces the four volumes, right there on the spot, the four great volumes, and he said, maybe you'll look at it, and then you want to buy it. So I asked him how much it costs, and I said, well, maybe I won't buy it. at that point, whatever. Anyway, I read the Sefer. I read a good segment of the Sefer at the Chasana. And then apparently he succeeded in selling a lot of copies of it at the Chasana. He came with an entire truck of the Sfarim. I mean, literally a truck. I'm not exaggerating. He sold many copies. And then he heard that I was the Mechanech and the Rav, etc., etc. So he told me, okay, I'm going to make a deal with you. I'm going to give it to you free of charge if you promise to read the entire Sefer. So I said, well, how long do I have? I may have asked him, Shana. I asked him, well, how long? I had four fat volumes, for goodness sakes. You know, it's not exactly. But then when I started reading it, I realized it was full of pictures. I like that kind of, I have to work too hard, etc. Illustrations and pictures. What, by the way, it's the best Sefer on Hilchos Shabbos in terms of reality. Because he has pictures and diagrams and illustrations. Okay, so I said to him, I agreed to do it with one tanai. I don't have to read the, what do you call it, Haaretz in the back. Because if I have to read that, that'll take me a lifetime. I said, forget about it. I said, I'm not going to do it. I'll tell you right now. At the end, I read the entire four volumes. It took me about 6 months. But four volumes of the entire Sefer. I called up the Mechaber afterwards. He actually remembered me. And And I was very taken. I think that it's the most beautiful sefer Hilchos Shabbos that is out there, according to my humble opinion. Again, it's not in Hebrew, obviously, but assuming that you want to. So this is the kind of sefer you should be familiar with, because it's very timely. He's the latest technology, deals with issues that are relevant, that are practically relevant to everyday life. Okay, in terms of what one should learn, you have to try to schedule. I can tell you, I have a brother, Shlito, and he's a Refuah Shleima now, but I have a brother, so he wakes up every morning at 5 o'clock, learns Daf Yomi for the last 40 years, maybe more than that. He's an accountant, he's a CPA, trust me, he works, he's in the workforce completely, lock, stock, and barrel, he wakes up every day at 5 o'clock and learns Daf Yomi. He's ready to Daf Yomi, very into it. And then in the afternoon, his lunch break, he hears the Daf Yomi Shia. Then he hears it a third time, goes to a third Shia. I once came to his neighborhood more than once, three or four times already, and all of a sudden the Rav, who was giving the Daf Yomi, was not there, so he asked me, do you mind giving Daf Yomi? I said, well, I really did mind, but since he's my older brother, Kabeh Esther, so therefore I said, okay, I'll do it. So I did it, you know, he destroyed me already three times already. That's Chazaka in destroying his younger brother. Literally, he knows Daf Yomi in the back of his hand. He's gone through Shas with these three times in the last 40 years. I don't know how many times he's gone through Shas. He's familiar with Masechtas all over the place, everywhere. I mean, you almost can't catch him, because this is a Balabait who works for a living, a CPA, and he has clients all over the place, etc., etc., etc. It's incredible, and he's very disciplined. You got to be disciplined. He's very disciplined. 5 o'clock is 5 o'clock a.m. Not p.m. And if you're disciplined, and he's a mathematician, so that's really where he's coming from. And if you have that kind of discipline, you could accomplish enormous amounts. I have a Balabatim and a shul of mine in Beit Shemesh who are outstanding Bnei Torah, outstanding, because they're disciplined. They're incredibly disciplined, and you can learn a lot. Then, okay, what you do exactly, as I said, depends on your situation and what you have to enjoy what you're learning. You must enjoy what you're learning. That's very significant. But at the end of the day, listen, all of us have to be connected in some form of fashion to Torah Shabbat Peh, to the study of Gemara and Mishnayos, whatever it may be. We have to try, but we have to know Halacha as well. Listen, it can be done. And everyone here can accomplish tremendous things. Everyone. Each one according to their potential, no doubt about it. All of you have outstanding potential, and we can accomplish a lot. Ooh, wow.
So I guess one short one connected to what Rosh Hashiva just said, and then I guess we'll stop with that. Is a lot of times people, when like they hear I have a job or whatever, is they'll like older people will ask me that on Shabbos, be like, oh, like what are you gonna be doing? Like how much are you gonna be making? Which I don't know why they're asking that. Like all these questions on Shabbos. So since Rosh Hashiva was discussing Hilchos Shabbos, is there any and if you go like, oh, it's Shabbos, I want to talk about it, they're like, oh, this guy's like such a firm guy, whatever, they make fun of you basically. Is there any word of, like, what are the parameters of what you can discuss on Shabbos?
Gemaras that we're learning in Kol Kisvei. Clear Gemaras. V'daber davar. Shelo yeh dibrucha shel Shabbos ge dibrucha shel chol. The way you speak on Shabbos, not the way you speak in the course of the week, and what you try to avoid. Business discussions. I mean, you don't read the Wall Street Journal on Shabbos, because Gzer Hashem, Shtari Yadyotas. You might come to read Shtari Yadyotas. These are Dinim Shachanach. Mentioned Klo and Dinim and Mechaber Shachanach. Okay, I mean, it's ideal. Okay, people love to discuss sports. Is that what you discuss on Shabbos, Jeremy? Not anymore. Wow, you're tzaddik. Sports are probably more to discuss. I don't see what the problem is. But as far as business dealings and the like, that's certainly something which is taboo, which is not appropriate. Now, the question, how do you deal with these people? I've been in many shuls also where they discuss the stock market and what's happening in the business and this, that, what have you. You have to try your best to steer the conversation. Someone actually asked me the last time I was in Chutz Aretz, I was in Shabbos in Chutz Aretz, and I was in a certain shul. Someone came over to me and started discussing me the business the business climate here in Eretz Yisrael. So what did I do? So they asked me about the business climate and about one or two of my Balabatim. So I said, do you mind if I first tell you a Dvar Torah on the Parsha? I use Rabbi Oblowski's approach. Anyway, so I started telling the Dvar Torah, and after 5 minutes he said to me, you know, I really have to run. I have to talk to this. This looks like there'll be a lengthy one. And I tend to be lengthy at sometimes. Anyway, so I took care of that problem. You have to be polite and at the same time try to, in general, steer the conversation, indicate that, you know, I'd like to discuss things that are more in sync with the Ruach of Shabbos and Onik Shabbos and things like that.
Can one at least say what they do?
What you do for a living?
Yeah, like, is that...
Yeah, besides that, I think the Yesh Makom Ba'akel Bezeh, that's not the problem.
Shukra,
want to give a big shukra to the Shiva? Take time, eh?